Probably not.
And I would mention it to them, I thought, just as soon as Gregory had calmed down a bit. In the meantime, I would do a bit of discreet investigating just as Jolyon Roberts had asked. First, I tried Bulgarian development projects in the Google search engine, but this turned out some 55 million hits, the first two pages of which appear to have nothing to do with the development project I was looking for. Next, I tried Balscott Bulgarian development project, and this turned up just two hits, but neither of them had any connection whatsoever with a low-energy light bulb factory on either side of the Danube. Next, I tried Europa, the official European Union website, but that was more difficult to navigate through than the continent itself. It was all a bit of a dead end without accessing the firm's Roberts Family Trust computer file to see with whom and where the contact had been made in Bulgaria or with the EU. And I daren't do that. I decided instead that I'd try to have a quiet look through the paper records we kept at the office. Shares and bonds may have increasingly been bought and sold online, but the digital deals were still all backed up with physical paperwork, and we were required to keep the papers for a minimum of 5 years. The office was consequently stacked high with boxes of transaction reports, and somewhere amongst them would be the Roberts Family Trust paperwork for their £5 million investment in the Balscott lighting factory. I sat back in the chair and thought about Claudia. I tried her mobile again, but as before, it went straight to voicemail without ringing. I wished now that I had told her about the article in the Racing Post when she had brought over my computer. I tried her number once more, and this time I did leave a message. "Darling," I said, "could you please give me a call when you get this? Love you. Bye." I hung up. I looked at the clock on Herb's desk. It was only 11:15. I had been here for nearly 3 hours, but it seemed like much longer. I wondered what Claudia could be doing at 11:15 in the morning and with whom that required her to have her phone switched off. I sighed. Perhaps I didn't want to know. In my role as Herb's executor, I used the account number and sort code on his statement to send an email to his bank informing them that Mr. Kovac was deceased, and would they please send me details of all his accounts and especially the balances. Somewhat surprisingly, I received a reply almost immediately, thanking me for the sad news and advising me that they would need various pieces of original documentation before they could release the information I had asked for, including the death certificate, a copy of the will, and a grant of probate. And how long would it take to get that lot? I heard Sherry go along the corridor to the bathroom. At least my troubles with Billy Searle were minor compared to hers. I took the front cover sheet off the Racing Post and folded it up, as if not being able to see the damning words would in some way limit their damage to my reputation and career. I put the offending piece in my pocket and went to throw the rest of it into the waste bin under Herb's desk. The bin had some things in it already, and I thought, as I've looked everywhere else, why not there? I poured the contents of the bin out onto the desk. Among the opened envelopes, the empty Starbucks coffee cups and the screwed-up tissues were lots of little pieces of paper about an inch square. I put the cups, envelopes, and tissues back in the bin, leaving a pile of paper squares on the desk. It was fairly obvious that they were torn-up remains of a larger piece, so I set about trying to put them back together. It was a bit like doing a jigsaw puzzle, but one without the picture on the box to guide me. I quickly established that the pieces had not been from one larger piece, but three. I slowly built up the originals in front of me. They were each about 6 inches by 4, printed forms with words written on them in pen, similar forms but each with different writing. I stuck the bits together with sticky tape.
"What are you doing?"
Sherry asked from the doorway. She made me jump. "Nothing much," I said, swiveling the desk chair round to face her. "How are you feeling?"
"Dreadful," she said, coming into the room and flopping down into the deep armchair. "I can't believe it."
I thought she was about to cry again. I wasn't sure whether the dark shadows beneath her eyes were due to tiredness or her tear-smudged mascara. "I'll get you some more tea," I said, standing up.
"Lovely," she said with a forced smile. "Thank you."
I went through to the kitchen and boiled the kettle. I also made myself another coffee and took both cups back to the living room. Sherry was sitting at the desk looking at the pieces of paper,
So I sat down on the arm of the big armchair.
"Do you know what they are?" I asked her.
"Of course," she said. "They're money home payment slips." She sipped her tea. "One for 8,000 and two for 5.
"Pounds?" I asked.
She looked at them. "Dollars. Converted into pounds."
"How do you know?" I asked.
She looked at me. "I use Money Home all the time," she said. "It's a bit like Western Union, only cheaper. They have agents all over the world. Herb sent me the money for my airfare via Money Home."
"Are any of these slips from that?"
"No," she said with certainty. "These are the slips you get when you collect money, not when you send it."
"So Herb collected $18,000 worth of pounds from Money Home?"
"Yes," she said.
"When?"
I asked.
She looked at the reconstructed slips carefully.
"Last week, but not all on the same day. 8,000 on Monday, and 5 each on Tuesday and Friday."
"Who from?" I asked.
"These only tell you which Money Home office it was collected from. They don't say who sent the money."
She drank more of her tea.
"What's all this about?"
"I don't know," I said. "I just found those torn-up sheets in the waste bin." She sat drinking her tea, looking at me over the rim of the cup.
"But why are you here anyway?" she asked.
"I was a friend of Herb's and a work colleague," I said, giving her one of the business cards from my wallet. "He made me the executor of his will." I decided again not to mention that he had also made me the sole beneficiary.
"I didn't know he even had a will," Sherry said, reading from my card. "Mr. Nicholas Foxton, B.S.C., M.E. Con, Dip, P.F.
"He made it 5 years ago when he first arrived at Lyle & Black," I said, ignoring her reference to my qualifications. "Everyone in the firm has to have a will. The senior partners are always saying that we can hardly advise our clients to plan ahead if we aren't prepared to do the same. But I have absolutely no idea why Herb chose to put me in his. Maybe it was just because we sat at desks next to each other. He'd only just landed in the country, and perhaps he didn't know anyone else. And none of us really expect to die when we're in our 20s anyway, but he should still have named you as his executor, even if you were in the United States."
"Herb and I weren't exactly talking to each other 5 years ago. In fact, I told him by then that I never wanted to see or hear from him again."
"Wasn't that a bit extreme?" I said.
"We had a flaming row over our parents," she sighed. "It was always over our parents."
"Well, what about them?" I asked.
She looked at me as if deciding whether to tell me. "Our mom and dad were, shall we say, an unusual couple. Dad had made a living, if you can call it that, acting as an unlicensed bookie around the backside of Churchill Downs. He was meant to be a groom, but he didn't do much looking after the horses. He spent his time taking bets from the other grooms and some of the trainers and owners, too. Sometimes he won, but mostly he lost. Mom, meanwhile, had worked as a cocktail waitress at one of the swanky tourist hotels in downtown Louisville. At least that's what she told people."
She paused, and I waited in silence. She'd say it if she wanted to.
"She'd been a prostitute."
Sherry was crying again. "You don't have to tell me," I said. She looked at me with tear-filled eyes.
"I've got to tell someone," she coughed. "I've bottled it all up for far too long."
Between bouts of tears, she told me the sorry saga of her and Herb's upbringing. It amazed me that I had sat next to Herb for all those years without realizing the hurdles he'd had to overcome to be a financial advisor. Herb and Sherry's father had been an abusive drinker who had seemingly treated his children as unpaid slave labor. Both of them had excelled at school, but their father insisted that they drop out age 16 to go to work, Herb as a groom in the Churchill Downs stables, and Sherry as a chambermaid in one of the tourist hotels where her mother had plied her trade. Herb had rebelled and run away to Lexington, where he had secretly applied for, and won, a free place at a private high school. But he'd had no accommodation, so he'd slept on the streets. One of the trustees of the school had found him there and offered him a bed. The trustee had been in financial services, and hence Herb's career had been decided. He'd stayed in Lexington after high school to attend the University of Kentucky on a scholarship before landing the top graduate job at J.P. Morgan in New York.
I wondered how such a high flyer had come to move from one of the global asset management giants to a firm such as Lyle and Black, a relative tiddler in the financial pond. Had he somehow queered his pitch in New York? Sherry, meanwhile, had been good at her job, and bright with it, and she had been spotted by the management of the hotel for further training. That was ultimately how she came to be in Chicago, where she was currently assistant housekeeper in a big hotel of the same chain. I didn't see how all this information was going to be of any use to me, but I sat quietly and listened as she unburdened her emotions. "How come you and Herb fell out?" I asked in one of the frequent pauses. "He refused to come home from New York for the funeral when Dad died. I told him he should be there to support Mom, but he refused, and he said he wouldn't come to a funeral either if she dropped down dead tomorrow." Those were his exact words. And Mom heard him say them because she and I were in my car, and the car was on speakerphone. She paused and more tears ran down her cheeks. "I still think it's the reason why she did it."
"Did what?" I asked.
"Swallowed a whole tub of Tylenol Extra, 100 tablets."
"Dead?" I asked.
She nodded. "That night, I found her in the morning."
She sat up straight and breathed in deeply through her nose.
"I accused Herb of killing her, and that's when I told him I never wanted to see or hear from him again."
"How long has it been since your parents died?"
"About 6 years, maybe 7.
She thought for a moment.
"It'll be 7 years in June."
"When did you change your mind?"
"What, about contacting Herb?"
I nodded.
"I didn't. It was he who contacted me. About 2 years ago."
She sighed.
5 years was a long time not to speak to your twin brother. I had wanted to be in touch with him much sooner, but I was too proud."
She paused.
"Too stupid, more like. He wrote to me at the hotel company, and we arranged to meet in New York. Then last summer, he invited me to come to England and stay with him for a holiday. It was great," she smiled. "Just like old times."
The smile faded and the tears began again.
"I just can't believe he's dead."
Neither could I.
I finally arrived at the office at 1:20, a time when I reckoned Gregory should be just sitting down to his substantial lunch at the far end of Lombard Street. However, I approached number 64 from the opposite direction to the one he took to his usual restaurant in order to minimize the chances of running into him if he was late. I ignored the lift, sneaked up the emergency stairway to the 4th floor, and put my head around the glass entrance doors. "Has Mr. Gregory gone to lunch?" I whispered to Mrs. McDowd, who was sitting at the reception desk. 10 minutes ago," she whispered back. "And Mr. Patrick?" I asked. "Went with him," she replied. "Both gone for an hour and a quarter at least, probably longer." I relaxed and smiled at her.
"Maybe I'll just stay for an hour."
"Very wise," she said with a grin from ear to ear. "Now, tell me, is it true what it says in that newspaper?"
"No, of course not," I said. She gave me one of her "I don't believe you" looks.
"You must have done something, or it wouldn't have been on the front page."
"Mrs. McDowd, it's nothing, I promise you."
She curled down her mouth as if she was a spoiled child who had failed to be given an ice cream. I ignored her, walking past the reception desk and down the corridor beyond. As I passed by, I glanced through the ever-open door of the compliance office, but Jessica Winter was not at her desk. Jessica was one of those who always went out for her lunch hour, as Herb had done, though in his case it was not to eat, but to work out at a local gym. I went on and into my office. Not that I had it completely to myself. There were 5 desk cubicles crammed into the small room, one of which was mine. Herb had been next to me, both of us close to the window, while Diana and Rory, Patrick's other assistants, occupied the 2 cubicles nearer the door. The 5th cubicle was no one's specific personal domain, but was used by any visiting staff, usually an accountant for 2 days a week, and Andrew Meller, the lawyer, if he needed a desk. Today, it was empty. Diana was out to lunch, as usual, while Rory was sitting at his desk typing with one hand on his computer keyboard, while holding a half-eaten sandwich in the other.
"My God," said Rory with his mouth full. "The Invisible Man returns!
Gregory's been looking for you all morning. You're in real trouble.
He sounded as if he was rather pleased about it, and I could see a folded copy of the Racing Post lying on his desk. It had probably been he who had showed it to Gregory. You haven't seen me, all right, I said.
Don't involve me in your sordid little affairs, he said rather haughtily. I'm not putting my career at risk for you.
Rory could be a real pain sometimes.
Rory, I said, when and if you ever qualify to be an IFA, you can then start talking about your career. Until then, shut up.
Rory knew that I knew that he had failed his qualifying exams twice, and he was now in the Last Chance Saloon. He sensibly kept quiet. I took off my suit jacket and hung it on the back of my chair. Then I sat down at Herb's desk and pulled open the top drawer.
What are you doing?
Rory asked somewhat arrogantly.
I'm going through Herb's desk, I said. I'm his executor, and I'm trying to find the address of his sister.
He wasn't to know that Herb's sister was in Hendon. Rory ignored me and went back to his one-handed typing. There was no sign of Sherry's address, but there were two more of the money home payment slips lurking in a drawer, and this time not torn up into squares. There was also another of the sheets with handwritten lists on both sides, just like the one Chief Inspector Tomlinson had shown me in Herb's flat. I carefully folded them all up and put them in my pocket. Apart from that, the desk was almost too clean. No screwed-up sweet papers or chocolate bar wrappers. I wasn't surprised. In fact, I was amazed there'd been anything at all. I would have expected the police would have stripped it completely bare on the Monday after his death. I looked around me at the cubicle. Some of the staff personalised their notice boards with family pictures or souvenir postcards sent by friends on holiday, but there had never been any such personal items pinned to Herb's. Not even a picture of Sherry. There was only the usual mandatory internal company telephone directory and a small key pinned to the board with a drawing pin. I looked at it closely, but left it where it was. A key without a lock wasn't much use. And there was nothing of interest in his waste bin either, which was completely empty. It would be, even if the police hadn't emptied it. The office cleaners had been in since Herb had last sat at this desk on the previous Friday afternoon. I walked along the corridor and put my head right into the lion's den. Now, Gregory, as a senior partner, did qualify for an office of his own, but fortunately for me, this particular lion was still out to lunch. I sat down in his chair and looked at his computer screen. As I had hoped, he hadn't bothered to log out from his session when he went to lunch. Most of us didn't. The office system was great when it was working, but it took so long to boot up that we all tended to leave it on all day. I typed Robert's Family Trust into Gregory's computer, and it instantly produced the details of the file on his screen, with the date of the original investment prominently displayed at the top. The access list in the right-hand corner showed me that Gregory himself had looked at the file only that morning at 10:22 a.m. precisely, no doubt in a lull from searching the offices for me. I just hoped he wouldn't notice that his computer had accessed it again at 1:46 p.m. However, it was one of the other names on the recent inquiry list I found most interesting. The list showed that Herb Kovac had accessed the file just 10 days previously. Now, why had Herb looked at one of Gregory's client files? It would have been most improper, just as it was for me to be looking at it now. Perhaps Herb had also had some suspicions about the Bulgarian investment. I wondered what they had been. It was too late to ask. I would have loved to print out the whole file, but unfortunately, the office server used a central printing system that recorded who had asked for what to be printed and when. How could I explain away an apparent request from Gregory when he was out to lunch? More to the point, how would I explain away sitting at Gregory's desk and using his computer if he returned unexpectedly early? I instinctively looked at my watch. It was 10 to 2. I reckoned I should be safe for at least another 20 minutes, but I had no intention of being even half that long. I flipped through the pages of the file trying to find the names of the Bulgarian agents involved in the project, but it was a nightmare, with PDF scans of the relevant documents all in the local Cyrillic script. It might as well have been in Chinese. I couldn't read any of the words, but I could read what I thought was a telephone number written in regular digits. I coppered it down on the back of one of Herb's money home payment slips. It began plus 359, which I knew from looking at the internet earlier was the international code for Bulgaria. I looked again at my watch. 2 o'clock. I opened Gregory's email box and did a search for Bulgaria. There were 6 emails, all from September 2 years ago. I glanced through them, but nothing seemed amiss. They were about European Union money, and they were all from the same source. I copied down the email address of the sender, yuri_yoram@ec.europa.eu, and also that of the recipient, dimitar.petrov@bsnet.co.bg. Gregory had been copied into the correspondence, but there was no sign of any replies. I took a chance and forwarded the emails to my private email address, then I deleted the forwarded record from Gregory's sent folder. I wished I could have emailed myself the whole Roberts file, but our security system wouldn't allow it. I reluctantly closed Gregory's inbox and the Roberts Family Trust file and checked that the screen appeared the same as when I had first arrived. I slipped out into the corridor, and no one shouted a challenge or questioned what I had been doing in Gregory's office. As everywhere in the offices, the corridor outside was lined with cardboard document boxes holding the paper transaction reports. I searched for the box containing those for the date at the top of the computer file. Mrs. McDowd may not have liked policemen very much, and she was definitely too nosy about the staff's lives and families, but she was very methodical in her filing. All the boxes were in chronological order, with dates clearly written in thick marker pen on the ends. I lifted up the box with the correct date and dug through its papers until I found the Roberts Family Trust transaction report and associated paperwork. I pulled them out, folded them, and stuffed them in my trouser pocket alongside Herb's money home payment slips before putting the box carefully back in the same place I'd found it. I glanced at my watch once more, 2:20. Where had those 20 minutes gone? Time I was away. But why did I suddenly feel like a thief in the night? I'd done nothing wrong. Or had I? Maybe I should just go and see Jessica straight away when she returned from lunch. But the client, Jolyon Roberts, had specifically asked me to have a discreet look rather than initiate a possible fraud investigation that would, as he put it, drag the good name of the Roberts family through the courts. Nevertheless, whatever else I might do, I didn't want to be in the offices when Gregory returned from the restaurant. I went back into my office to collect my jacket. "Leaving already?" said Rory sarcastically. "What shall I tell Gregory?" I ignored him. As I walked down the corridor towards the reception area, I realized with a heavy heart that I'd left it too late. I could hear Gregory and Patrick talking. I would just have to face the music.
"Ah, there you are, Foxton," Gregory announced at high volume. "I've been looking for you all morning."
I was so mesmerized by Gregory that I hardly took any notice of a man standing to the side of him, next to Patrick. But the man suddenly stepped forward right in front of me. "Nicholas Foxton," the man said. "I arrest you on suspicion of the attempted murder of William Peter Searle." Chapter 7. I spent the afternoon waiting in an 8-foot-by-6 holding cell at Paddington Green Police Station, not quite knowing what to think. The man in the office had identified himself as another detective chief inspector, this one from the Metropolitan Police. I'd missed his name. I hadn't really been listening. I did, however, remember him advising me that I didn't have to say anything with the proviso that it might harm my defense if I didn't mention something when questioned that I later relied on in court. I'd been too shocked to say anything anyway. I had just stood there with my mouth open in surprise as a uniformed policeman had applied handcuffs to my wrists and then led me down in the lift to a waiting police car. "William Peter Searle," the chief inspector had said when I was arrested. That had to be Billy Searle. So, Billy had been right about one thing. Thursday had been too late. I suppose I couldn't really blame the police for arresting me. Hundreds of witnesses had heard Billy shouting the previous afternoon at Cheltenham. "Why are you trying to murder me?" had been his exact words, even if the Racing Post had distorted them somewhat. I hadn't been trying to murder him, but I hadn't taken him seriously either. But to whom could Billy have owed so much money? clearly someone who was prepared to try to kill him for non-payment by the Wednesday night deadline. I sat on one end of the cell's fixed concrete bed and went on waiting. But I wasn't particularly worried. I knew I had nothing to do with Billy's or anyone else's attempted murder, and surely it would only be a matter of time before the police discovered that. First, Herb Kovac and now Billy Searle. Could the two be connected? Thursday afternoon dragged on into early evening, and I was left alone in the cell still waiting. For the umpteenth time I looked at my wrist to check the time, and for the umpteenth time saw no watch. It had been removed when I was checked in to the custody suite by the custody sergeant, along with my tie, my belt, my shoelaces, and the contents of my pockets, including Herb's money home payment slips and the transaction report from the box outside Gregory's office. The cell door opened, and a white-shirted policeman brought in a tray that held a covered plate and a plastic bottle of water. "What time is it?" I asked.
7 o'clock, he said without looking at his watch.
"How much longer am I going to be kept here?" I asked.
"The DCI will see you when he's ready," replied the policeman, who then placed the tray down next to me on the concrete bed and went out.
The door clanged shut behind him. I looked under the cover. Fish and chips. And quite good, too. I ate the lot and drank the water. It took about 5 minutes. And then I waited some more, counting the bricks in the walls of the cell in an attempt to alleviate the boredom. It failed. The detective chief inspector finally opened the metal door long after the barred and frosted glass window had turned from daylight to night black.
"Mr. Foxton," he said, coming into the cell, "you are free to go."
"What?" I said, not quite taking it all in.
"You are free to go," the detective said again, standing to one side of the door. "We will not be charging you with any offence."
He paused, as if not being quite able to say the next bit.
"And I'm sorry for any inconvenience that may have been caused."
"Sorry," I said. "Sorry? I should bloody well think you are sorry. I've been treated like a common criminal."
"Mr. Foxton," the chief inspector replied, somewhat affronted, "you have been treated exactly in accordance with the laid-down regulations."
"So why was I arrested?" I demanded.
"We had reason to believe you were responsible for the attempted murder of the jockey, William Searle."
"So what's happened that now makes you so sure I'm not responsible for it?" I was purposefully making myself appear angry. It might be the only chance I would have of asking the detective for some answers, and I wanted to take advantage of his defensive position.
"I am persuaded that you could not have been present when Mr. Searle was attacked. You have an alibi."
"How do you know?" I said. "You haven't asked me any questions?"
"Nevertheless," he replied, "I am satisfied that it was not possible for you to have committed the attack, so you are free to go." I didn't move.
"How are you satisfied that I couldn't have done it?" I asked with persistence.
"Because it is physically impossible for you to have been in two places at the same time. That's what having an alibi means. Alibi is a Latin word meaning somewhere else, and you were somewhere else when the attempt was made on Mr. Searle's life."
"So where was this attack?" I asked. "And when?" The chief inspector looked uncomfortable, as if he didn't particularly like answering questions. No doubt he was more relaxed when asking them.
"Mr. Searle was deliberately knocked off his bicycle on the road outside his home in the village of Baden in Wiltshire at exactly 7:05 this morning. He is currently in a critical condition at the Great Western Hospital in Swindon."
"And how are you so sure I was somewhere else at 7:05 this morning?" I asked.
"Because you were at 45 Seymour Way in Hendon exactly 55 later, he said. "You were interviewed at that address at precisely 8 o'clock by Detective Chief Inspector Tomlinson of the Merseyside Police. There is no way you could have travelled the 72 miles from Baden to Hendon in 55 minutes, especially not at that time of the morning during the rush hour."
"And why didn't you work this out before I was arrested?" I was beginning to sound rather self-righteous, even to my ears.
"We were simply acting on a request from the Wiltshire Force," he replied, neatly passing the blame elsewhere.
"Well, then they should have checked," I said, trying to maintain a look of rightful indignation. "Maybe I'll sue you for wrongful arrest."
"I think, sir," he said very formally, that you will find that attempted murder is an arrestable offence, and that we had reasonable grounds for an arrest. Just because it turned out that you couldn't have been the perpetrator doesn't give you grounds for claiming false arrest. Hmm, I said. So I am now free to go, just like that? Yes, he said. No questions? No police bail? No, sir, he replied. An alibi is a complete defence. It doesn't mitigate a crime, it proves innocence. So there would be no point in charging or bailing you? However, I am sure that the Wiltshire Force will want to ask some questions about your argument with Mr. Searle at Cheltenham Races yesterday. No doubt they will be making an appointment in due course. You are free to go home now, he said. He waved a hand towards the doorway, as if trying to encourage me on my way. I'd had enough of the cell, and I didn't need his encouragement to leave it. The custody sergeant sneered at me as he returned my watch and mobile phone, my tie, belt and shoelaces, and the previous contents of my pockets. He clearly enjoyed booking prisoners in far more than letting them go. "Sign here," said the sergeant without any warmth, pointing at a form on the desk. I signed. "Thanks for the supper," I said cheerily. The sergeant didn't reply. "Which way out?" I asked, looking around at various doors, none of them with a convenient exit sign above it. Perhaps it was designed that way to confuse any escapees. "That way," said the sergeant, pointing at one of the doors. He pushed a button on his desk, and the lock on the heavy steel door buzzed. I pulled it open and walked out into the police station reception area as the door closed automatically behind me with a loud clunk. Claudia was waiting there, sitting on an upright tubular steel chair that was bolted to the floor. She jumped up when she saw me and rushed over, throwing her arms round my neck and hugging me tight. She was crying. "Oh, Nick," she sobbed into my neck. "I've been so frightened." "Come on," I said, hugging her back. "Let's go home." We walked out into the night hand in hand and hailed a passing black cab. "I didn't think you'd be here," I said to Claudia as we sat down. "Why ever not?" she said. "I've been here ever since I found out where they'd taken you. It's been bloody hours." "But how did you know I'd been arrested?" "The police had allowed me only one call, and I'd made that to the company's lawyer, Andrew Meller." "Rosemary called me," Claudia said. "She was in floods of tears." "Rosemary?" I asked. "You know," she said. "Rosemary McDowd. She's such a dear." I had worked at Lyle & Black for 5 years, and for all that time, I'd had no idea that Mrs. McDowd's name was Rosemary. The receptionists were always referred to as Mrs. McDowd and Mrs. Johnson, because that's what they called each other. Only the other staff had first names, Mr. Patrick, Mr. Gregory, Miss Jessica, Mr. Nicholas, and so on, and we were only addressed in that way because, again, that was how the Mesdames McDowd and Johnson did it. "How did Mrs. McDowd have your number?" I asked. "Oh, we speak quite often." "What about?" I asked. Claudia didn't reply. "What about?" I repeated. "You?" she said. "What about me?" I asked. "Oh, nothing," she said evasively. "No, come on," I said. "Tell me, what about me?" Claudia sighed. "I sometimes call her to find out what sort of mood you're in when you leave the office." More likely, I thought suspiciously, to check that I was actually in the office or when I'd left it. "So what did Mrs. McDowd tell you today?" I asked, purposely changing the conversation's direction. "Between sobs, she told me that you had been arrested by the police for attempted murder. I thought it must be to do with Herb Kovac, but she said it was about someone else." I nodded. "Billy Searle was attacked this morning. He was a top jump jockey, and also a client of mine."
"What the hell's going on?" Claudia said.
That's what I wanted to know. It had been nearly 11 o'clock by the time I'd been released, and I'd asked the taxi driver to go to the newspaper kiosk on the Edgware Road, where I knew they received the early editions of the daily newspapers the night before. Claudia stayed in the cab as I went to buy copies of all they had, including the Racing Post, which arrived in a van as I was paying for the rest. If its previous day's front-page headline had been vague and set as a question, this one pulled none of its punches. "Billy Searle attacked. Foxton arrested for attempted murder." And the article beneath gave no comfort to me either. Further to our exclusive report in yesterday's Racing Post concerning a heated argument at Cheltenham Races on Wednesday between top jump jockey Billy Searle and ex-jock turned financial wizard Nicholas Foxy Foxton, we can exclusively reveal that Foxton was yesterday arrested for Searle's attempted murder.
Billy Searle was taken to the Great Western Hospital in Swindon from the scene of an horrific incident in Baden near Lambourne early yesterday morning, when it appears he was deliberately knocked from his bicycle. Doctors at the hospital state that Searle's condition is critical, with a broken leg and serious head injuries. Foxton was arrested yesterday at 2:25 p.m. on suspicion of attempted murder at the Lombard Street offices of City Financial Services firm Lyle and Black, and he is currently being held for questioning at Paddington Green Police Station. Remarkably accurate, I thought, except for the bit about currently being held at Paddington Green Police Station, and that had been right until about 20 minutes ago. Beside the article was another picture of Billy Searle, this time all smiles and wearing a business suit, and a photograph of the cordoned-off village of Baden. Overlaid across the top right-hand corner of this photo was a smaller head-and-shoulders shot of me, positioned, to my eye, as if to imply my presence in Baden High Street. Gregory was going to have a field day in the morning. It wouldn't just be my head he would have on a stick, it would be my career as well. Who would trust a financial advisor who is on the front page of a national newspaper having been arrested for attempted murder? Not me, for one. I climbed back into the cab with the papers and showed the racing post to Claudia. "It's so bloody unfair," she said, reading the headline. "How can they mention your name when you haven't even been charged? You should sue." "Over what?" I asked. "They haven't said anything that wasn't true." "But why do the police give out names before they charge someone?" I suspected that the information had not come from the police, but from a source much closer to home. The time and place of the arrest were too precise and too accurate. The police would have only said something like, "A 29-year-old man has been arrested and is helping with our inquiries." My money would be on Rory to be the office mole, although what he hoped to gain by it was anyone's idea. He couldn't have my job without passing his IFA exams first. And even I didn't believe he would have murdered Herb for the cubicle close to the window. It would have been Diana's anyway. I looked at all the newspapers before I went to bed, and all of them had front or back page reports about the attack on Billy Searle. None of them had the full facts, but each still managed to mention me by name and imply my guilt. Oh God, I thought. My mother would see them in the morning, and it was far too late to call and warn her now. I switched on the television and watched the latest news on one of the 24-hour news channels. They had a report, live, from Baden. "It appears," said the reporter, "that the jockey Billy Searle was leaving his home to ride his bicycle to Lambourne as he did every morning. He was due to ride horses at morning exercise. He was being waved away by his girlfriend when a car, which had seemingly been waiting in the street, suddenly accelerated into the bicycle, knocking Searle violently to the ground before being driven away at speed. Billy Searle was taken to hospital in Swindon, where he is in a critical but stable condition with head and leg injuries. Police are asking anyone who may have any information concerning the incident to come forward. A man who we believe to be the ex-jockey Nicholas Foxton was arrested in connection with the attack, but he has since been released without charge." "Well, at least they said you'd been released," said Claudia. "I'd rather they hadn't mentioned my name at all," I said. "You watch. Most people will think I'm guilty. They would already have me tried and convicted in their minds. Being released will make little difference. What I need is for the police to catch the real attacker and for him to confess. Even then there will be plenty of people who'll still believe I did it." "It's so unfair," Claudia said. Indeed it was. But complaining about it wasn't going to help. I just hoped that they arrested the real culprit soon. Claudia and I went upstairs to bed, but I couldn't sleep. I lay awake in the darkness, going over and over everything in my head. Last Saturday morning, my life had been so settled and predictable, and my career path mapped out to success and riches, even if it was a little boring. But the last 5 days had seen so much change. I had witnessed one murder at close range and been arrested for attempting another. I'd begun to doubt my relationship with Claudia, even suspecting that she might be having an affair with someone else. And I'd gone behind the back of my superior at work to access his personal emails to try to determine if he was complicit in a multi-million-pound fraud. Not to mention becoming the executor and beneficiary of someone that I hardly knew, who then turned out to have a twin sister. And then, to top it all, I'd been propositioned for sex by a woman nearly 20 years older than me, and I'd also discovered the real heartbreaking reason for my parents' unhappy marriage. It was enough to keep even the most tired of men from sleeping. I tossed and turned for hours, as I mulled over what I should do next, and also over whether I would still have a job to go to in the morning. I woke late after a restless night, the space in the bed next to me already empty and cold. I rolled over and looked at my bedside clock. It was gone 8 o'clock and I was usually on the tube by now. The phone beside the clock started ringing loudly. I decided I didn't want to talk to anyone, so I didn't pick it up, and eventually it stopped when Claudia answered downstairs. I turned on the television for the news. Billy Searle's attempted murder had been downgraded from the top story by a government U-turn on schools policy, but it still warranted a report from Baden Village, and they still managed to mention me by name and show my picture in spite of my release. At this rate, the whole bloody world would believe me guilty. Claudia came into the room. "It's your mother," she said. I picked up the phone. "Hello, Mum," I said.
"Darling," she said, "what the hell's going on? You're in all the papers and on the TV."
She sounded very upset, as if she was in tears.
"It's all right, Mum," I said. "Calm down. I didn't do anything, and the police know it. Otherwise, they wouldn't have released me. I promise you, all is fine."
It took me about 5 minutes to calm my mother down completely. I knew when I'd managed it because she told me to get up and have a good breakfast. Eventually, I put the phone down and laid my head back on the pillow. "Aren't you going to the office today?" Claudia asked, coming back into the bedroom carrying 2 cups of steaming coffee. It was an innocent enough question, so why did I straightaway wonder if she was checking on my movements in order to plan her own?
"I don't know," I said, taking one of the cups from her. "What do you think?"
"Things could be worse," she said. "You could still be in that police station or in court. Let's look on the bright side." "What plans do you have?" I asked.
"Nothing much," she said. I might go shopping later.
"For food?"
"No," she said. "I need a new dress for the show next week."
"Oh," I said, "I've forgotten about that."
The thought of attending the opening night of a new West End musical with all the associated press coverage did not now fill me with great joy. Claudia and I had accepted an invitation from Jan Setter to join her at the star-studded event and at the after-show party. I wondered if, after my clumsy brush-off at Cheltenham, Jan would now be so keen for me to be there, to say nothing of my subsequent arrest. "Look on the bright side," Claudia had said. "Things could indeed have been worse. I could have still been stuck in that unwelcome cell. Or I might have been lying in a Liverpool mortuary refrigerator like Herb. Or in a Swindon Hospital intensive care bed like Billy. Things could have been a lot worse."
"Right," I said with determination. "It's time to show a defiant face to the world. I'm going to get up and go into work and bugger what anyone thinks. I'm innocent, and I'm going to act like it."
"That's my boy," said Claudia with a huge grin.
"Bugger the lot of them."
She lay down on the bed and snuggled up to me, slipping her hand down under the sheets in search of me.
"But do you have to go immediately, or..."
She grinned again. "Can you wait a while longer?" Now I was really confused. Had I been reading the signals incorrectly? "Let me think," I said, laughing with joy as well as expectation. "Work or sex? Sex or work? Such difficult decisions." "Not really. Sex won. Easily." I didn't go into the office until after lunch, but that was not solely due to having fun and games in bed with Claudia. It was because I went to Hendon on the way to check on Sherry and to collect my laptop that I'd left on Herb's desk.
"What happened to you?" she said, opening the door. "I thought you were coming back yesterday afternoon."
"I was," I said, "but I was detained elsewhere." I decided not to elaborate. "What have you been up to?"
"I've started going through Herb's things in his bedroom," she said. "I got fed up doing nothing, and it somehow seems to help."
"Did you find anything of interest?" I asked as I followed her down the corridor to the bedroom.
"Only this," she replied, picking up something from the bed. "It was at the back of his wardrobe, hanging on a hook behind his coats."
She handed me a small blue plastic box with a clip-on lid. Inside the box, all neatly held together by a rubber band, were 22 credit cards. I rolled off the band and shuffled through them. As far as I could tell, they matched the statements right down to the variations in Herb's name.
"Why would anyone have so many credit cards?" Sherry asked. "And why would they all be in a box hidden in his wardrobe? They all look brand new to me."
And to me, I thought. Herb hadn't even bothered signing them on the back. These cards had been obtained solely for use on the internet, but I knew that. I'd seen the statements. Underneath the cards were four pieces of folded-up paper similar to the ones that Chief Inspector Tomlinson had shown me the previous morning. I looked at the lists of numbers and letters. The first columns on each side were definitely dates, but they were written in the American way with the month first and then the day, so 2-10 was the 10th of February. All the dates on these pieces started 1, 2 or 12, so were from January, February or December. Sherry was sitting on the floor, busily looking through a chest of drawers, lifting out neat piles of T-shirts and stacking them on the bed. I left her and went out of the bedroom along the corridor and into the living room. The handwritten lists I had photocopied yesterday were still on the desk next to my computer, along with the photocopied bank and credit card statements. The dates on those lists all started with a 3 for March. I took them back to the bedroom. On all of the lists, the second and third columns definitely looked like amounts of money, and the fourth column was a list of capital letters, possibly initials. I counted them. There were 97 different sets of letters.
"What are you looking at?"
Sherry said. "I don't know exactly," I replied. "Lists of numbers and letters. Have a look." I handed her the sheets. "I think the first column on each side are dates, and the next two are probably amounts of money."
"In dollars or pounds?" she asked.
"I don't know," I said slowly. Was that why I wondered the amounts on the credit card statements didn't match the amounts on the sheets? Were one lot in dollars and the other in pounds? I left Sherry studying the lists while I went back to the desk for the statements and Herb's calculator. "What's the exchange rate for the US dollar to the pound?" I asked, coming back into the bedroom.
"About $1.6 to £1, Sherry said. "At least it was last week, but it changes all the time."
I multiplied some of the amounts on the credit card statements by 1.6 and tried to match the new figure against any on the handwritten lists. It was a hopeless task. I didn't know the exact exchange rate, and there were over 500 different entries on the 22 statements. Some of the amounts were close, but none were exactly the same. The best I could say was that they might have been related. "Do you recognize any of the initials on the lists?" I asked Sherry.
"Is that what they are?" she said.
"I don't know, but they look like it." She shook her head. "Did you know that Herb liked to gamble?" I asked. She looked up at me.
"Of course," she said. "Don't all men?" "Herb had always been one for an occasional flutter on the horses, just like his father had been. Must be in the genes."
"Did you know how much he gambled?" I asked.
"Never very much," she said. "He may have liked the odd bet, but I know he believed that gambling had ruined our childhood. He would never have staked more than he could afford to lose. I'm absolutely sure of that."
"And how much could he afford to lose?" I asked.
"What are you getting at?" Sherry said.
"Herb gambled a lot on the internet," I said. "A huge amount." She was shocked.
"Are you sure?"
I nodded. "He must have spent hours every day gambling on internet betting sites and playing poker on the virtual tables in online casinos. And he lost. He lost big time."
"I don't believe it," Sherry said. "How do you know?"
I held out the photocopies of the credit card statements to her. "Herb lost more than £90,000 last month alone, and the same the month before."
"He can have done," she said with a nervous laugh. "Herb didn't have that sort of money."
"Look for yourself," I said, handing her the statements. She looked at them for a moment, but I could see she was crying again.
"Do you think that's why he was killed?" she asked.
"I don't know," I said, "but I thought it quite likely." She cried some more.
"I wish he'd never come to England," Sherry said sadly. "Herb wouldn't have been able to gamble like that at home. Internet gambling is illegal in most of the United States."
So it was. I remembered reading about the head of an internet gambling website who'd been arrested when he'd arrived at a U.S. airport and charged with racketeering, simply for allowing Americans to gamble on his website, even though it was based in England. It had all been about accepting credit card accounts with a United States address. I looked again at the handwritten lists of dates, amounts of money, and initials. And I pulled from my pocket the money home payment slips I had found in Herb's office cubicle. Only last week, according to the torn-up payment slips I'd found in his waste bin, Herbert received three large amounts of cash, two equivalent to $5,000 and one to $8,000. Suddenly, all of it made complete sense to me. It hadn't been Herb who had lost £90,000 last month. It had been the people whose initials were to be found on Herb's lists. The 97 people who were responsible for the 512 different entries on the credit card accounts. And I'd like to bet they were all Americans. If I was right, Herb had been running a system to provide 97 Americans with a UK-based credit card account in order for them to gamble and play poker on internet betting and casino sites. But why would that have got him murdered?